En Cox, estamos un paso adelante. Como el muchacho que ya sabe la orden de tu cafecito incluso antes de pedirlo.
¡Hey, José! ¿Café con leche sin lactosa, un toque de vainilla, templadito sin azúcar?
En Cox también nos adelantamos a lo que necesitas. Por eso el precio de tu plan no subirá por 3 años. Y nuestra seguridad avanzada protegerá tu red de amenazas antes de que pasen. Cox, un paso adelante. José, llamada de tu jefe en 3, 2, 1. Al menos 500 megabits por segundo de velocidad y Cox Unlimited Mobile. Impuestos y cargos no incluidos en garantía de precio. Velocidad de datos móviles reducida tras usar 20 gigas al mes.
Hi, Wild Thing listeners. I've got some good news and some better news. First, the good. I'm hard at work on season 3 of Wild Thing. Yeah, COVID is making it a little hard to report from the field, but I promise it will happen. In the meantime, here's the better news. While the main 10 story episodes for season 2 are finished, I'm going to be releasing a bonus interview every month until season 3 comes out. These interviews will be with scientists, ufologists, artists, and writers, all kinds of different people who have something interesting to say about extraterrestrial life. Like, for instance, the woman we'll be hearing from today, Clara Sousa Silva. She works at MIT and was one of the scientists that found evidence for potential life on Venus. That's right, Venus. The week season 2 launched in September 2020, scientists announced that they had found traces of a gas called phosphine in the clouds of our next-door neighbor. On Earth, only microbes and laboratories make the gas, which raises the question of whether the phosphine on Venus might indicate that there's life there. There's still a lot of research and testing and retesting and re-retesting to be done before we'll have an answer, but it's still pretty exciting to think about. Clara Sousa Silva was a member of one of the teams working on this finding. She's something of an expert on phosphine, and she's an astro-quantum chemist, which is a very cool job title for a job I know nothing about.
There's a lot of quantum chemists who you kind of study the way that molecules behave at the tiniest scale and how they vibrate and rotate and what that does to light that comes near them. But very few of them apply that work to astronomy. And so that's what makes me a quantum astrochemist.
All right. And you're the first of your kind, or one of a few of your kind?
I'm trying to convince more people to say they're quantum astrochemists. I once was at a conference where some journalist said, quantum astrochemistry, is that an emerging field? And I almost spat out my drink because it is very emerging in that I
you're birthing
coined
it.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, yeah, I'm, at the top of my field and at the bottom of my field.
I am the field.
I am the field, exactly.
Before we get into the findings from the paper and what your work was on this and what you did, I kind of want to just help people understand what Venus is like as a planet. Can you tell me a little bit about this neighbor of ours?
So Venus is fascinating in many ways. And one of them is that it really makes us revisit our notions of habitability, because we usually think of planets as habitable or not based on the conditions on the surface, and whether they have a surface at all, and whether they have an atmosphere at all. And in those criteria, Venus looks pretty bad. It does have a surface, it does have an atmosphere, but it is hell down there. It's so hot, the pressure's so high, lead melts, no level of complexity, no matter how different from ours it is, could ever survive. And so I think we dismissed it slightly once we discovered quite how awful it was there. And also we dismissed it because all the probes we sent dramatically melted on the way down. And that's really discouraging for visitors. And so other planets like Mars seemed, if not more habitable, at least more docile. And so Venus did sound bad. And it is pretty bad. But it has a variable atmosphere. And there is an envelope of the atmosphere that's, technically speaking, potentially habitable. This was something that was proposed a long time ago. And it's not entirely surprising because the surface used to be habitable before a runaway greenhouse effect destroyed it. And now we have this ever-shrinking habitable layer of the atmosphere that could be inhabited. Now, that's a big maybe. But it does make you think that habitability is not just about the surface, is not just about whether a planet is in the habitable zone where liquid water can exist. You can have these pockets of habitability in these sub-regions of a planet. And it does really open up the field for what locations in the galaxy could be inhabited.
And so just to be clear, the surface of Venus, we know it's inhabitable. What happens? Does it just destroy DNA? Why couldn't anything live there?
Yes, complex chemistry fails, biotic or otherwise, but certainly life could never reach enough complexity or stability at those temperatures and pressures. Everything is just hindered and destroyed and melted.
But then you get up into the atmosphere and the pressure has lessened and the temperature has lessened, and there's the possibility that that environment up there might be more habitable.
More habitable is perhaps the crucial term here, in that, yes, the pressure is suddenly wonderful. The temperature is a warm summer day on Earth, I mean, but it's still, you know, drier than the driest place on Earth. It is still more acidic than the most acidic place on Earth. It's just awful as a place to go if you are life like anything on Earth. So it's still not particularly habitable for us and the life that we know. But it's at least somewhere closer to a place where some form of life could survive.
Something that really likes acidity and no water.
It's something that doesn't need water, doesn't care for water the way we do. We're really, you know, obsessed with it. And I can imagine that if there are Venusians, again, big if, they think our obsession with water is a little excessive.
Okay. So we had done prior missions to Venus, and as you said, the probes had melted on the way down. So we were like, okay, that's not really working. Is that the point at which we stopped going to Venus, or, you know, what made us decide to take a closer look at Venus again?
Well, not many people were looking, and certainly we haven't sent probes there for decades. But Jane Greaves, who was the lead author on the Discovery paper that came out in September, she was looking at possible biomarkers all over the solar system, and including the clouds of Venus. Yes, it hadn't got a lot of attention in you know, the last few years, but it was still known to be a potentially habitable place. We just hadn't found any signs of anything that could be traced back to life. And so phosphine was a really unusual molecule to look at all, if nothing else, because phosphine until very recently wasn't considered a biosignature, even on Earth. So the idea of looking for a molecule that was barely associated with life on a planet that we knew was unlikely to be able to host life was not a particularly popular one.
So it was just a matter of like, let's take a closer look. We have different technology. We have different ideas of where life might be found. Why not go back to some of the ground we've supposedly trod over before?
And specifically looking for phosphine was not something anyone would have thought to look for. Phosphine is not an obvious biosignature to anyone. And so it was both a location and a marker that were unusual to look for. And I'm really impressed with Jane for considering it at all. But even Jane will admit that she didn't really expect to find it there. It was more of a check something off a list than believe that it will be there. And so I think both Jane and I and everyone on the team were extremely surprised to find phosphine on Venus.
I definitely want to get to your response when you started finding this. But let's talk a little bit about phosphine. I don't know quite what it is. And I would imagine most of the audience doesn't either. So can you tell us a little bit about what phosphine is, why it's important, why it's significant, what produces it?
So phosphine is quite a simple molecule, though that does not mean it's simple to make. It's shaped like a tiny little pyramid with a phosphorus atom at the top of the pyramid and three hydrogen atoms at the base. It's actually very similar in many ways to ammonia, where you have the same base of hydrogens, but at the top of the pyramid, you have nitrogen. So phosphine is this four-atom molecule, so quite simple. And the reason most people haven't heard of it, well, maybe until now, is that it's really not present on Earth in abundant quantities. And in fact, it's produced by very few things, and the way phosphine was known at all on Earth is because it is such an effective killer that for a long time we have used it as a fumigant for pesticides. And also we used it as a chemical warfare agent in the First World War and most recently by ISIS.
Oh, wow.
And so it's pretty awful.
What does it do? What makes it such an effective killer?
So it interacts with oxygen metabolism and any kind of system within the body that relies on oxygen kind of shuts down very quickly. But it is produced with enormous effort through human ingenuity, specifically to be deployed for its killing abilities. It also smells terrible. Not the actual pure gas itself, but all the other phosphines that are produced at the same time. And very few people have actually smelt it and lived to tell the tale. But the reports that we have is that it's basically smells like garlicky, fishy death. And it's horrific because we love oxygen. At some point in our evolution, we had to choose between oxygen and phosphine. And I'm frankly relieved that we chose oxygen. I think it was a great choice. But it does mean that phosphine is very much avoided by most life on Earth. It is extremely toxic. It is destroyed quite quickly by the radicals in our atmosphere. And it's also extremely difficult to make. So it is not made spontaneously. You have to put a lot of effort, a lot of energy into a system to make it. And so you really shouldn't find it anywhere on Earth. But we do. And we find it not just because humans make it for their terrible means, but because there is life on Earth that doesn't rely on oxygen. And these anaerobic beings are cool with phosphine because they don't rely on oxygen metabolism. And there are rich worlds kind of in the shadows all over Earth that don't rely on oxygen, and phosphine is produced there and that is released into the atmosphere.
So are these places like swamps, or like where's an anaerobic location on Earth? I'm just trying to give people a sense of where you might find it here.
Swamps indeed. And swamps are by far the most pleasant of the list of ecosystems. Swamps and kind of marshlands and rice fields produce phosphine, the life there, for the reason that they don't rely on oxygen like we do. But also basically the farts and excrements and intestines of most animals. These are rich anaerobic worlds too that don't rely on oxygen, and their phosphine is produced in large quantities. For the same reason, sewage plants also produce a lot of phosphine.
Oh, interesting. So, but it's not enough phosphine that someone who's working in the rice field or in the sewage plant would be killed by it?
Or smells their own farts? No. No, the phosphine is produced in small quantities and it gets destroyed quite quickly. And so we are all fine. I still wouldn't go and take a deep inhale on, you know, a penguin poop, but it's mostly safe, yes.
Okay. So if phosphine breaks down very, very quickly, in order to be able to find it somewhere, it means it has to be constantly being produced.
Exactly. And that's quite an exciting facet of potentially discovering it on Venus, that something has to be continuously producing it.
Let's back up a little bit and talk about what the study was. What, if you can kind of delineate what you were trying to accomplish and what came out of the paper or what came out of the research.
So there were two projects in parallel, effectively. So Jane, who led this project, was looking for biomarkers in a variety of places, Venus included. And she had got this tentative detection of a signal that would more or less align with one of phosphine's spectral features on the clouds of Venus, and knew that was strange if it was real, but didn't really know anyone who understood phosphine in an astrobiological context. But in parallel, I and the rest of my team at MIT, we had been working on this extremely hypothetical and I thought probably useless, if I'm being honest, long project for many years now, since 2015 really, trying to hypothetically consider what would happen if we ever detected phosphine on a rocky exoplanet. I'd worked on phosphine for my entire PhD, specifically to understand how it interacted with light. But for the last 4 years or so, I have been trying to investigate if we found it on a terrestrial planet, what would it mean? And could we do it with near future telescopes? And it was really difficult to consider every possible hypothetical terrestrial planet I could conceive of and trying to figure out if we found phosphine on those atmospheres, coming up with all the possible processes that could maybe make it. And then also collecting this huge body of evidence to show that phosphine is associated with life to some extent. And I had finally completed it and submitted it in 2018, having found a quite interesting, but not exactly controversial, conclusion that phosphine was indeed associated with life on Earth, as long as it was anoxic life. It was detectable with near-future telescopes on a variety of terrestrial exoplanets, and it had no detectable false positives for life. So if we found it on a rocky planet, it could only mean life. And I submitted this paper, and it was in revision for a long time, but it was a cool conclusion. I was certainly proud of this work, but it wasn't exactly controversial because I was just talking about a hypothetical situation. Even I didn't really think it would happen before I retired, for sure, but maybe in my lifetime. And it was exactly at this moment, it was, I think, 2 months after I submitted this paper, that I got an email from Jane saying, hey, I think I found phosphine on Venus. I'm pretty sure it's weird. How good a biosignature is it? And that's how our collaboration started, with trying to figure out if my now seemingly quite extraordinary conclusion that it could only mean life could possibly apply to the case of Venus. And so you can see that this was a long and multifaceted set of projects that came together into this discovery paper that then came out in September.
Wow. So basically, you guys were doing, the two of you were doing independent work and then realized that there was some overlap here, that there was a way that both of your work could be incorporated into this larger study.
Exactly. And of course, Venus is technically within the bounds of habitability, if you're very generous. But even my most extreme theoretical exoplanets that I was considering weren't, you know, Venus extreme. And so there was a lot of redoing that work to see if the same conclusions were maintained in somewhere like Venus. And I should point out, the majority of this work, and certainly the leader of this side of the work, was William Baines, who's a wonderful scientist and who are configuring out these false positive scenarios, both for my paper and for Jane's.
Okay. So just to clear things up for people who might not be as familiar with some of the terminology, you know, you're talking about spectral signatures of phosphine. And I'm assuming that this is kind of, is this along the lines of spectroscopy, where you're looking for phosphine in the
You're doing great.
I'm not a scientist. I'm sorry.
You can do this.
But basically, there's a wavelength that phosphine is putting out, and that's getting absorbed by the atmosphere.
That's great. You could have said that without the question mark at the end. You did great. If we had video, you could see me nodding encouragingly on my side. Yes, that's about correct. Each molecule has a kind of a spectral fingerprint of its own that tells you how it's interacting with light. And I spent my entire PhD actually calculating the exact spectral fingerprint for phosphine. And so these wavelengths that phosphine can absorb of light, I calculated 16.8 billion of them. And one of those is what we found on Venus.
So that's what Jane was looking for. And you knew all the ins and outs of phosphine because you're the queen of phosphine.
Yes, that's a decent summary.
So she was like, oh, I need Clara's brain on this because she really understands phosphine and will help me understand if this in fact is what I'm seeing and if in fact there might be phosphine in this atmosphere and what that would mean, which would mean potentially life.
I don't think my role is quite that special, but yes, I had kind of gathered a bit of a reputation for knowing everything about phosphine because that was my PhD and that's what I talked about at conferences a lot. And I think Jane had gone most of the way to figuring out certainly that it was very strange to find it on Venus. And I had already established a team. So even on my side, it wasn't just me, of course. And when I was at MIT, between Janusz Petkowski and William Baines, who did a lot of the biochemistry, we had already done that work. And so it was ready made for Jane to integrate into her own work.
Got it. Okay. So Jane found evidence of phosphine in the atmosphere of Venus. And what was the response to that?
My response to that when I heard it?
Yeah.
Well, it was mixed feelings, because the scientist in me was, of course, very skeptical. This seemed highly improbable, highly implausible. And astronomers often make mistakes in assigning molecules. This is something I spent a lot of time in my work doing, is approaching astronomers who claim they have found a molecule on the spectrum of some astronomical body. And I point out, well, you found a single feature that could correspond to that molecule. But at the resolutions that we have, many molecules could be responsible for the same feature, because molecules are technically unique in the way they interact with light. But that's only if you can look at infinitely accurate resolutions. And so this was a single feature on a planet where we really wouldn't expect to find phosphine. So my scientific self was very skeptical. My personal self, who has been dedicating herself to a molecule no one cared about for a decade, I was very excited, of course. And also, you know, I had just submitted this paper hypothetically claiming if you found phosphine on a terrestrial planet, you would have found life. And I never dreamt that I actually would, never mind 2 months after submission. So I was kind of trying to rein my own excitement in, but I was very excited, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, I'm sure. So how do we figure out what's producing the phosphine on Venus? Do we have any way of doing that?
So it's very difficult, because it basically involves this almost never-ending process of proving a negative. So thinking of any way you could make phosphine anywhere, and then seeing if that would apply to the environment on Venus. But as we go through the list of known processes that can make phosphine, we do feel like we eventually run out of options. So right now we have tried dozens of processes. We have considered every known way of making phosphine, and we have excluded those on Venus. They are insufficient to explain the presence of phosphine, at least in the abundances that are estimated by the observations. And at that point, of course, you could say, well, you've run out of non-biological options, so it must be life, because life could explain the presence of phosphine on Venus. But it's also quite possible that we just missed something, that there's some unknown production mechanism for phosphine, some strange, exotic chemistry that can also produce phosphine. So at what point do you decide that strange exotic biochemistry is now just as likely or more likely than this unknown exotic chemistry that you can't figure out yet?
Yeah. I mean, there's no way to really figure that out without getting a sample, right?
Well, most of my work is looking at exoplanets where we would never be able to get a sample. And so my focus is, how do you unambiguously show that life is present when you can't just go there and check? And there are many ways to do this. So the first is to figure out, is it phosphine without ambiguity? And for that, we need more features that can confirm it can't be any other molecule mimicking itself as phosphine. And when you do that, you should also be able to figure out how phosphine is distributed across Venus. So if it is being produced by biosphere, it will have a patchy distribution that changes with not just time, but space. It changes with seasons, the way molecules produced by life change on Earth. But then if it is life producing phosphine, it's not going to be one type of microorganism producing one molecule. It's going to be a whole ecosystem producing not just phosphine, but a variety of molecules. So getting more information about what that potential biosphere is doing, so what molecules are there, is how we would confirm a biosphere. You can think of an analogy, the concept of alien astronomers looking at the Earth trying to figure out if we have life. they wouldn't just detect oxygen and retire and be completely convinced that they just found life, because look at all that oxygen. It's weird. It's a sign of life. At those quantities, it's really hard to make it abiotically. No, they would spend a lot of time painting a full picture of our biosphere, not just the methane, but all the other trace gases that together and with their variations across latitudes and seasons and years paint a complete picture of an active biosphere. And so we can still do the same to them.
What would we be looking for next? Like, is there an obvious next step in terms of, okay, we found phosphine, now we should look for, I don't know, another chemical?
Yes. Now we should look for another chemical is absolutely true. So there are many things you can do. One place to start would be to look for other molecules that would be needed if phosphine is being formed. So all the formation pathways involve other molecules that would provide that phosphorus and that hydrogen that eventually forms phosphine, and other molecules that are produced when phosphine is destroyed. So a chemical network that tells us, you know, gives us at least some notion of what's going on before and after phosphine is made. You also have all the other molecules that we have some inkling are on Venus because they were tentatively detected by other observations. And we can make sure we map those as well and eventually build this 3D map of what's going on. It will also help us understand if it's being produced abiotically, phosphine, I mean, how it's being produced, because we'll see the kind of precursors to phosphine. Sadly, we don't have spectra for the majority of these molecules, so our toolkit is really spotty. Mixed metaphors there, but our toolkit is not great. We're missing the majority of spectral data, the fundamental reference data, to analyze any observations of exoplanets and Venus.
Why is that?
Hard to know. I can venture a guess. It's really arduous and ungrateful work that is deeply underfunded. So I did this for my PhD. You know, my entire PhD was focusing on phosphine. And I many times thought, what am I doing? You know, just drenched in sweat and tears. And it was just so much work to do just the spectra for one molecule that no one really seemed to care. You know, people cared about the big molecules, so methane, ammonia, water, ozone, the molecules that are really important for the atmosphere on Earth. And I never really thought I would get a job afterwards because it was such a niche thing to do. And a lot of people just think this data just exists. You know, we just know how to detect molecules, but 96% of the molecules that could form any given biosphere are completely unknown. We have no way of detecting them. And so we're just missing a lot of data. And this stuff never really gets funding because it's not particularly shiny to say, oh, I'm going to get some fundamental data. So it goes in a reference book that someone can use someday.
Yeah. Can I ask why phosphine? What was it about phosphine that made you decide to devote your life to it?
Well, I'm hoping that my career is young enough and that I'll survive academia so I can focus on other molecules too, but it's a fair question. Why did I get into phosphine at the beginning? Well, when I started my PhD, I wanted to understand exoplanet atmospheres. And it became quite clear that this gap in our fundamental data that we need to interpret any shiny observations we make was something to be addressed. And so I think I felt like it was a public service. And I liked the idea that even if my work led to nothing, people generations after me, if they felt the need to find phosphine somewhere, they would now have the tools to do it. And I reassured myself that it was a form of legacy that I could be proud of. But the reason I became kind of focused on phosphine, it was partially because it was assigned to me by my PhD supervisor who thought molecules like methane were far too important to be left in the care of a completely green PhD student. And phosphine was interesting to the group at the time and the reason they were assigning it to me in the first place, because it was known to be present in the observable layers of Jupiter and Saturn, which are fascinating planets in many ways, but finding phosphine in these layers was really unexpected, because they shouldn't really be able to form phosphine. They're far too cool, and there's not anywhere near enough hydrogen pressure for phosphine to be formed spontaneously. So it's very strange to find phosphine where we see it. Not alien strange, but definitely still strange.
So if you're finding phosphine on Venus, and that might be indicative of life, and then you're finding phosphine on Jupiter and Saturn, is that also indicative of life?
So no, because Jupiter and Saturn have access to these extreme environments where phosphine can be made spontaneously. And these environments can exist in a few places, but they're places like stars or brown dwarfs or these gas giants. Terrestrial planets have access to no such places. And so there's nowhere where phosphine can be spontaneously made. It has to be made through effort, like on Earth. And on Earth, phosphine is still made, just not accidentally. It's made through human ingenuity, or in the case of anoxic life, by putting a lot of energy, a lot of sacrifice into making phosphine. And sacrifice is something life is willing to make, but the universe doesn't like to waste energy. And so there's no way of making phosphine accidentally on terrestrial planets like Earth or Venus, at least that we know.
So on Jupiter and Saturn, it's because they are gas giants, and it has to do with both the heat and the pressure that's happening closer to the... Is there a surface on a gas giant?
No, no, not in the way we can consider it a surface. Yes, enough pressure and enough heat, but some more astute listeners may point out that heat and pressure is something that Venus has in large abundances. And there, the important distinction is, it's not just any pressure that makes phosphine a viable molecule to be made. It's a specific form of pressure, and that is hydrogen pressure. So you need a lot of hydrogens, basically with nothing better to do, that are pressured into bonding with phosphorus. But most hydrogens do have better things to do. They like making water by bonding with oxygen. They like making methane by bonding with carbon. And there aren't enough hydrogens free to bond with phosphorus in an environment like Jupiter. So there's a lot of pressure, but not a lot of hydrogen pressure. But stars and gas giants have a lot of hydrogen. So making hydrogen pressure is something that's very easy to them.
So what happens next? Are there plans for missions to Venus to gather more information? And what are your thoughts about that possibility?
Ah, yes. I don't work on missions very closely, but I do work a lot on interpreting the data we get from missions. And often these extremely expensive missions, which are wonderful feats of engineering and involve extremely dedicated and talented teams of people, have limited insights from their data because our fundamental spectra and our fundamental information about what we're looking at is flawed. We know so little of which molecules are present in the places we're looking at. We know so little about how molecules interact with one another in foreign environments. So we get this extremely impressive data, but from which our insights are necessarily limited. And funding this improvement in reference data is so crucial and so important, but it's always ignored in favor of these very impressive but very expensive missions. And so, of course, I'm not immune to the charms of a shiny machine going next door and collecting a sample of potential life. But I am worried that there would be better investments, and certainly investments that need to happen before we go, that are simply being overlooked, about getting fundamental lab data and fundamental theoretical data on what we expect to see. And that's how I feel about almost all missions and space telescopes. But with Venus, there's the added element that if it is life, and that's a big if, I don't have enormous faith, given humanity's history, that we'll handle that well. We don't have a historical reputation for going to places that aren't ours and treating them with respect. And I don't want our first interaction with alien life to be a potential, you know, massacre. Never mind that they could harm us. So there's a lot of ethical concerns here that I worry about. And I feel that if it is life, then instead of being more excited about going there, I'm less excited about going there. I think we should be more cautious about venturing there if there's any chance there's life.
Yeah, I'm kind of torn. I agree with you. And yet there's something also very exciting about going and seeing. I think that's probably a very human response to new discovery, is wanting to see it with your own eyes. But I also agree that we have not necessarily been either very kind or very careful when it comes to new species, new civilizations, new anything. So I understand that caution as well.
And there can just be a case to be made for exhausting all the information we can obtain about Venus and any potential Venusians from Earth. There are a lot of observations that can be done with ground-based telescopes, and there are a lot of observations that can be done with orbiters, and there are a lot of experiments that can be done in the lab to simulate the clouds that can help us interpret all of these observations. And there's also a case to be made that we could use Venus as a lab if we do this. Because when we next find phosphine or any other potential kind of promising biosignature on an exoplanet, we won't be able to go. And so we will be relying on these remote sensing methods and these on-Earth analyses to interpret what we're seeing. And with Venus, we can ultimately go and check and use that as an effective testing bed for all our theories that we can never do in exoplanets. And I think we should prioritize exhausting these much cheaper and less ethically compromised steps before we go there and just aggressively scoop them up and look at what we're interacting with.
That was Clara Sousa Silva. She was one of many scientists involved in finding evidence of potential life in Venus's atmosphere. Their findings were published on September 14th, 2020, in the journal Nature Astronomy. You can find out more about Clara's work on her website, clarasousasilva.com, and you can follow her on Twitter, at Dr. Phosphine. You can follow us, too, at Wild Thing Pod. And if you want to be kept in the loop about what's happening with Wild Thing, you can sign up for our mailing list. Go to wildthingpodcast.com. This podcast is a production of Foxtopus, Inc. Our executive producer is Scott Carney. Editing is by Alicia Lipinski, and the score and sound mixing come from Louis Weeks. I'm your host and creator, Laura Krantz.